Welcome to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Chris Messini. This is part three of our partnership with the Spokesman Review, presenting their Summer Stories short fiction series. Each year, the newspaper asks several local authors to write a short story around a particular theme. This year's theme was Summer of 69. Tonight, we'll hear two different interpretations on that theme from authors Sharma Shields and Sherry Jones. To begin, here's Sharma Shields reading her story, Good Little Mice.
Good Little Mice. After the offensives, after the riots, the murders, and then, to their surprise, the music, the mother shuttered the windows and locked the doors. To keep you safe, she said. Her three children blinked up at her from the divan. She switched on a lamp, unplugged the television set. They trailed her into the kitchen for their breakfast. She poured her fear into their breakfast cereal. She stirred her hatred into their Ovaltine. A man on the moon, she said, clicking her tongue. A war in the jungle. Murderers in the hills. Homosexuals in the streets. Her disgust flavored their meals, bitter and sharp, dandelion greens, citrus peels, rose thorns, and metal. The children chewed and swallowed and bled. Soon they wondered aloud, what will happen to us if we go out there? The mother fell to her knees, grabbed the eldest by the shoulders. Her face was a pale fire of urgency and love. If you go out there, she said, they'll harm you. Winged men with bare breasts and razor-sharp talons will pluck you from the earth. They'll drop you from a great height. Your bones will splinter and snap. Warriors made of aluminum and titanium will spit a thick, viscous jelly on you, melting your eyeballs. Wild-haired maidens, violent with drugs and lust, will fall on you and tear you apart piece by piece. They'll package up your remains and send them off to a cold, lifeless moon just to be rid of you. Here she paused, her voice catching. You'll forget about me, and I you, and there will be no saving you. She was so desperate, so sincere. The children loved her. They promised her that they understood. They quit their many questions. They reassured her, putting their little hands on her face and back. Yes, Mama, we will stay. Don't worry. We'll never leave you. At first, it was joyous. No school, no piano lessons, no routines. Their mother gave them permission to rummage in her drawers and closets, to upend her jewelry box with its sparkling treasures, to explore the dank basement with its old tools and rusted machines, and they reveled in the house's darkest corners. For exercise, they jogged up and down the big staircase, or they jumped rope in the echoing blue bathroom. One day, they threw a ball in the den and broke their mother's cherished Italian vase. They went still, hearing her anxious footfall. The coral fragments lay like fresh wounds against the beige floor tiles. She would punish them, they worried. She would cast them out. But she did no such thing, only retrieved a broom and swept up the pieces without comment. It occurred to them, we can do whatever we want. There was one rule and one rule only, stay here. The days grew long in the dark house. They had always been good, obedient children, but now their confinement released them from such habits. Their behavior worsened. They beat one another with pickup sticks. They pushed one another down the flight of carpeted stairs. They trapped the cat in a roasting pan in the oven. Arms outstretched, they sailed like gulls through the big house, knocking down picture frames in the hallway, delighting in the sound of splintering wood and glass. Their mother smiled patiently. She cleaned up their messes. Nothing can touch us here, she said, and the children relaxed into her relief. Look at how happy she is, they marveled. They mistook her gladness for their own. They forgot about their brick schoolhouse, playing with friends, the outings to the park with its pretty stone bridge, where they'd once seen dozens of small brown frogs leap across the grass like a mud. They locked all of this, the frogs, the memories, somewhere deep inside. They believed in their purported toxicity. The mother continued to feed them her fear, her horror, her lust for homogeneity. They drank it all down in tall glasses of tang, scarfed it up on toast dripping with chicken a la king, licked it out of the center of warm Pop-Tarts. Ravenous, they consumed whatever she gave them. Their small bellies grew taut with her terror. When the mother left for the store, they wailed at the slicing brightness. They sobbed with relief when the many locks clicked shut behind her. Now and again, they overheard the awful noises of the exterior world, a shriek of delight, a car backfiring, a marching band, obstreperous, menacing, with its throbbing percussion and screaming horns. Their mother had taught them that even music was dangerous, so they cowered against the walls, holding one another, sobbing. When the silence returned, so did their ease. One evening, the mother returned from the store with a bar of chocolate. "You've been good little mice," she said, and she broke off a piece for each of them. They ate, remembering a long dormant sweetness. The next morning, served breakfast by candlelight at the laminate table, the middle child pushed her plate away. She hadn't taken a bite. "If you're unwell," the mother said, "then back to bed." The middle child met her mother's eye with unusual frankness. She was not as wild-eyed with fear as her siblings, but there was doubt there, a cracking open of a question. She rose, hesitated a moment as if to say something, but then seemed to decide against it. She went to bed. Later, she emerged to play with her brother and sister. "What's wrong with you?" they asked her. She ignored the question, took down a board game, Candyland, and began unpacking it quietly in a corner. "She's sick," the brother said. "She's stubborn," said the younger sister. "She'll feel better after she eats," the brother concluded, and then he and the younger sister raced off to flood the bathroom, to smash the dishes, to carve their names into the kitchen cupboards with the mother's sharpest knives. The middle child refused to eat at the next meal and at the next. Days went by where she did nothing but stare sullenly at the heavy window coverings. She studied them as if she could see clean through them. They wondered what she imagined there, blackbirds, nuclear clouds, hippies, starlight, people electrified by drugs or love or napalm. Could she see the winged men, the warriors, the bands of wild cannibal women? The middle child sipped at water and nibbled at small hunks of bread, but only if her mother hadn't smeared them with the fatty cheese of her hatred. The daughter's eyes bulged in her bony face. Her ears seemed to expand as the rest of her shrank. She did look like a mouse now, trembling, aware, hungry, but not for what the mother offered her. At night, their mother safely snoring in her own room, the brother and sister gathered around the middle child's bed. "What's wrong with her?" demanded the sister. "I'm worried about her body," said the brother. "We'll force feed her canned peaches," suggested the sister. "We can easily pin her down." Their voices rose and fell, arguing, wondering. They talked about her as if she wasn't there at all. The middle child closed her eyes, turned away from them. She was both weak and powerful. In the dimness of the lamplight, translucent with hunger, her body shone. One day she didn't come down to breakfast at all. The siblings went to check on her and found her bed empty, the sheets disheveled, the comforter puddled on the floor. They looked in the closets and the bathrooms and the basement, all of the usual hideaways, and found no trace of her. Their mother took up the search, checking the windows and doors. They were still latched from the inside, deadbolts and chains secured. The children held their breath, their mother disappearing behind the cumbrous drapes. Finally, she emerged from the last window covering, sighing with relief. "She must be in the house," she said. "She's still safe." The children looked at one another, disquieted. They wondered if there were other ways to leave the house, chimney flues, air ducts, the stinking wet pipes. Their sister had been so small at the end, so diaphanous, she might have slipped like a piece of paper beneath the slat of a door frame or through a crack in the wall. How effortless it would be for her to disappear into the chaos of the outside world, a world bent on change no matter how static they remained, how defensive, how ensconced. They pictured her there, trodden and torn and dirtied. They shuddered. The mother must have seen their concerned expressions. She knelt and opened her arms to them, drawing them close. The two children huddled there on the carpet with her, arms laced, knees touching, their only comfort their togetherness. "All is well," the mother said. "The doors are locked, the windows secured. We're safe here. Nothing has changed." They almost believed her. They started to relax, told themselves they could be happy here, smothered by what they were told was love. But then the sister sat upright, startled, and then the brother did too, palm cupping his ear, and soon even the mother ceased whispering and went very still, listening. There was a pause, and then the noise started up again, a sound in the walls, a scratching, a rending, tiny sharp claws scraping the plaster, keen fangs tearing at the insulation, faint at first, but then more and more determined, whatever creature dwelling there, hell-bent on escape or entry.
We just heard Sharma Shields read her summer story from the Spokesman Review, Good Little Mice. And so, Sharma, the prompt for this year was Summer of 69. So when you got that prompt, how did you go from that to this particular story and this family?
Well, I was thinking about how there are some major similarities between 1969 in America and what's been happening recently in America. So I think that very first line in the story where it talks about the riots, I was thinking of Stonewall there, of course. It talks about the murders, and I think I was thinking of the Manson murders probably, but also the war that was happening overseas and the violence and sort of this xenophobia and hatred of the other that I think we see a lot of now. And then, to their surprise, the music, which to me was kind of an artistic response to that. I pulled all of those details in to start the story, but I didn't feel like I wanted the story to be historically discussing those so much as to become a fairy tale about fear, a mother's paranoia, and her desire to keep things homogenous, to keep things the same, and how that ends up really harming her children in the end.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to see the way that various people have taken this theme. Some have taken it very literally and set it, you know, in the 1960s and dealing with all the things that you talked about directly. And yours, I think, is maybe the most allegorical or, like you said, like a fairy tale.
Yeah.
So what made you interested in taking that rather than, you know, setting it at Woodstock or something like that?
Well, I think it's because I really saw so many parallels to what was happening now. So I did want a certain timelessness to the story. And I feel like writing with this sort of deadpan fairy tale tone has been something that I've been really enjoying lately. And I wonder if it's because I'm reading so many fairy tales to my children. But what I love about those fairy tales is I think they've stuck around with us because we do find the metaphor within them really powerful. And I wanted the metaphor for the story to not just feel like it was discussing 1969, but to feel like it was discussing right now.
I've been talking with Sharma Shields, author of Good Little Mice, the short story featured in the Spokesman Review's Summer Stories series. Thanks, Sharma.
Yeah, thank you.
This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Next, we'll hear author Sherry Jones read her short story, Eat, Drink, and Be Merry, originally published in the August 3rd edition of the Spokesman Review, which interprets this year's summer stories theme, Summer of 69, in a completely different way.
Eat, Drink, and Be Merry. All Jack wants for his 69th birthday is to celebrate the way people used to. Around the table, feasting with friends, everyone happy. Is that too much to ask? A party in these times? When Jack had apparated to his daughter's place with the invitation, her husband, Bob, hadn't even tried to hide his contempt. He'd smirked at Sunny, who shook her head ever so slightly, But Bob was never to be dissuaded from speaking his mind, especially when he had something negative to say, which was always, "Nabob," Jack calls him under his breath. "While Rome burns, Nero fiddles," Nabob said. "Typical of your generation." How has Sonny put up with this loser for so long? At their wedding, Jack had restrained himself from leaping to his feet during the "speak now or forever hold your peace" part. "Maybe it won't last," he'd consoled himself. "The cake tasted like ash. Not a good omen," he'd said, hope rising in his heart, until his wife had pointed out that, with all the fires now, even the air was tinged with a je ne sais quoi of ashes and dust. But not at his party. At Jack's party, the flavors will be delicious. The prime rib will ooze with blood, rare and succulent, not like the prefab meat that his mealmate prints out. He'll serve the printed kind. He has no choice. But with his new Genie environment simulator, it will look, smell, and taste the way meat used to when it came from animals instead of machines, before the blazing sun sucked all the juice from the planet, leaving a shriveled husk. Imagining the astonishment on Nabob's face when he takes that first bite of beef tonight almost makes up for having to invite him. They said technology would save humanity from destruction. They were wrong. But, thanks to Jack's new toy, technology might save the day. The operator chimes 10 minutes before the 5 o'clock start time. When Jack accepts the request, it's no surprise who appears. Destiny, his girlfriend from high school. The one that got away, he likes to joke, except that it's not really a joke. She's always punctual, which is why she and Jack, who is perpetually late, didn't work out. He watches as she appears before him in a granny dress and big sunglasses, her long white hair curling wildly, the very image of Janis Joplin had she lived to be 69. She's holding the fingers of one hand up in a V. "Happy birthday, Jack," she says. "You look groovy. Give me a birthday kiss." She hands him a package wrapped in blue paper decorated with peace signs and kisses him on the lips. Jack's body snaps too, on the alert in ways he hasn't felt since his wife died 4 years ago. But before he can go for another kiss, the operator chimes, and Justin, his best friend since college, joins them in a flowing beard and tunic, a red mark like a thumbprint between his eyes. "I am overwhelmed with joy to see the entire youth of America gathered here in the name of the fine art of music," Justin says in a badly contrived East Indian accent, his eyes bright as he waits to be identified. Jack shrugs. How in the hell would he know? It's been a century since Woodstock, way before his time. "Sri Swami Sachidananda," Destiny shrieks and throws her arms around Justin's neck. "What's the secret of happiness, Swami?" "Let us not fight for peace, but let us find peace within ourselves first," the Swami says. "No politics today, okay?" Jack hooks his arm around Destiny's waist. She giggles and says something about free love, but then the guests are apparating into his living room, one after the other, and soon his house is filled with musicians from Woodstock. Richie Havens and Joan Baez and Carlos Santana and the entire Grateful Dead band. Jack makes a wish to hear the Joplin song, "Peace of My Heart," and the genie fills the room with her gravelly voice, and he thinks, "Bring on the LSD," and colors begin to pulsate and swirl through the room. After a round of purple haze cocktails and a couple of joints, Jack checks his watch. Sonny and Bob are late, as usual. They refuse to apparate, Bob suspicious of the technology, saying the government could too easily snatch anyone in transition and send them to a torture camp, or worse. The government can do that anyway, Jack had argued. They can show up at your doorstep to take you if they choose. But why would they bother with Jack's crowd? He and his friends aren't activists, not anymore. They'd all been young firebrands protesting in the streets for a Green New Deal, but the 2020 elections had filled them with despair. Nothing anyone could do would make a difference now. Many of them had even stopped voting. What was the point? They might as well focus on living their lives as best they could. "I've got the munchies. When do we pig out?" Janice says. She grins, proud of herself for researching 1960s slang, and Jack ushers her to the chair beside his own. The room looks great, he has to admit. So far, the genie has proven a wise expenditure. As the guests take their seats at what appears to be a table covered in white linen, under what appears to be a crystal chandelier, Jack's doorbell rings. He makes a half-hearted wish, wanting to see Sonny but dreading the nabob's nattering attempt to put a damper on the day. The genie opens the door, and into the dining room bursts Sonny in a too-short miniskirt, and Bob in pork-chop sideburns and a flowered polyester shirt. "Cool, you two. Dig those crazy threads," Destiny says, giving Jack a sly look. The Woodstock theme was her idea. Jack had resisted, saying the event had too much political baggage, all that peace and love, but she'd called him a square, which made him relent. She'd promised him it would be fun, and now he sees in her eyes the pride of being right. Jack grins, wondering if he might get lucky on his birthday this year. But Bob cuts their moment short with his usual histrionics. "My God, what are you all doing?" he cries, waving his hands. "Don't you know what's happening outside?" "I don't go out these days," says Emily, in her wig and mini dress resembling a plump Joan Baez. "The world has gotten so ugly." "Don't you watch the news? There's a big firestorm coming this way," Bob says. "It's already destroyed half the city. We've got to get out of here now." "The news is too depressing. It disturbs our inner peace and fills us with despair," the Swami says, lighting another joint. "Turn on, tune in, drop out." Jack shuts his eyes. What's the kid going on about? Get out? To go where? The whole world is on fire. Has been for several years. The planet is a living hell, and the only escape is right here, in this room. "People are going crazy out there, Dad!" Sonny's eyes are wide and filled with tears, running all around the streets like ants from a kicked nest, smashing windows and heads, smoke and heat and dead bodies everywhere. "Enough!" Jack stands up so quickly, his chair clatters to the floor. "There's nothing we can do." "Should we apparate to a safer place?" Destiny says, standing too. "There is no safer place," Jack says, his thundering tone making her jump. "Damn that nabob," throwing a wrench into what's supposed to be his day. "This is all your fault." Bob's hands clench into fists, like he's about to start throwing punches. He glares at Jack's friends, sitting around the table in their optimistic colors, their love beads, their smoldering reefer passing from hand to hand. "We're all going to die. The earth is in flames, and it's because of you. Your generation gave up." This is getting out of hand. How can Jack make it stop? All he'd wanted was a nice celebration. In the corner of the room, he sees the genie, an orb pulsing a purple glow, and forms a wish that Bob and Sonny had never come to his party. And just like that, they're gone. Disapparated to who knows where, maybe, hopefully, back to their home. A disoriented hush has fallen over the room, the sound of a party falling flat. Jack feels a twinge of regret for sending his daughter away, but mostly he's relieved that the disruption has ended. He'll make it up to Sonny later, but for now, he's got a birthday to celebrate. He steps over to the sideboard and moves the platter of printed meat to the center of the table. As he lifts the silver lid, he makes a wish for juicy prime rib, and the beautiful slices of pink and brown meat evoke oohs and ahs from the dinner guests. Destiny leans over the platter slightly and inhales the aromas as she resumes her seat, her cheeks flushed, angry over being yelled at, or, he hopes, excited for what's to come. Jack unveils other dishes, transforming printed food with wishes into buttery potatoes, a red wine reduction, asparagus spears, a Caesar salad, sliced peaches and plums. The Woodstock Festival was 100 years ago today, Justin, a.k.a. the Swami, says, as they pass the dishes around, and Jack wishes the bottles of flat homemade beer into champagne and a fine Cabernet. 450,000 people gathered for 3 days of music and peace. Does anyone know what they ate? While his friends call out answers ranging from the absurd to the vulgar, Jack turns to Destiny and apologizes. He shouldn't have snapped at her, he says. She gives him a puzzled look. You snapped at me, she says. And Jack realizes the genie not only made his daughter and her husband disappear, it truly granted his wish and erased their arrival completely. No one but him remembers that they were even here. No one but Jack is thinking of the violence outside the door, the bodies strewn in the street, the wall of fire rolling toward them at this very moment. The Swami stands, lifting his glass. I propose a toast to our good friend Jack, celebrating his 69th birthday on this day in 2069. Thank you for treating us all to this delectable and nourishing meal, the likes of which we haven't enjoyed in many years. A boom drowns out his voice and shakes the room. A window explodes and sends shards of glass flying. One lodges itself in Justin's forehead, and blood splatters his tunic and the white tablecloth. Destiny screams, but Jack, having the hang of things now, wishes the explosion had never occurred, and in the next instant, the window is intact. The Swami is finishing his tribute, and everyone is raising their glass in a birthday toast to Jack. This party's a gas, Janis Joplin says, squeezing his thigh under the table. Jack winks at her, takes a swig of champagne, and lifts his fork and knife. Thanks for coming, everybody, he says. Eat, drink, and be merry.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf. Join us tomorrow for two more summer stories from authors Chris Crutcher and S.M. Hulse. And if you miss one of these great stories, you can find the full text at spokesman.com, or you can listen to the Bookshelf podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or the NPR One app. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini.